Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for April 7th, 2024. My name is David McLaughlin. Join me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have y'all both on and good to about 20 minutes. We're going to have for multiple times now our guest, Rachel Bitticoffer. She is going to come on and talk about her brand new book, Hit 'Em Where It Hurts. And so we're excited to have that conversation with her. But until then, we have been really mulling, trying to, you know, get into this, but there's so much going on here. We really have to go deep on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his campaign. We've discussed him in the past. I think we did a buy-sell-hold many weeks ago. But now he's got a VP candidate. He's starting to try to get on the ballot in certain states. A lot more talk about a lot more issues. And we're going to try to take different pieces of this one at a time. But let's start off with his VP candidate, Nicole. And honestly, I didn't put her name in front of me, which was a mistake on my part. But she's a lawyer in Silicon Valley, and she, one side of her background has a lot of professional qualifications. But you find out about one issue, and you go, "Oh, that makes sense." Nicole Shanahan, it just came to me. She is an anti-vaxxer. She's big into the anti-vax movement. She's donated money to his campaign, including, I think, the lion's share of the money that he used to put on that ad during the Super Bowl. Tim, what are your thoughts on this VP pick? Just one as a pick, and then two, let's look at, you know, will it help, hurt, or have no impact on his overall standing?
Well, it'll help because she's got money and access to Silicon Valley money. She's a tech lawyer. And is actually married to, I believe, one of the founders of, is it Google?
Yes.
You know, somebody like that.
She's divorced from him.
Yeah, she is a Democratic fundraiser, gave a lot of money to the Democratic Party. So the thought is, if she's going to help him get any voters, it's going to be more progressive type younger voters. So he was lucky to find anybody, and he had to hurry up and find somebody, as we'll talk about in a minute, because of some state laws requiring it. So,
yeah. Catherine, I guess there is the money angle. She brings some, you know, personal wealth from either her own career or her marriage and then divorce to Google's, one of the co-founders, which obviously that's one of the, you know, most lucrative companies started in the past 25 years. Do you think that the real selling point is the money, or is there something else?
I think it's the money, and I also think it's the fact that she's a woman from California. I think that those are helpful attributes. But once you delve into her, you know, you don't have to go very far to find the anti-vaxxing, the anti-IVF, the kind of some of the wacky like health related ideas she has. You don't need to go, like I said, you don't need to go very, very deep to find the flaws in her sort of ability to be a policymaker or, but I mean, the same is true of RFK Jr. There's not a lot of realistic policy acumen, but there isn't with Trump either. So, you know, that doesn't seem to matter much anymore.
Yeah, Catherine, you kind of brought the discussion because we know about the anti-vax, and I'm sure we'll get more into that. But you mentioned IVF. Does she have any opinions that she stated on, you know, reproductive rights in general, or she kept most of her public comments to the realm of in vitro fertilization?
Well, she doesn't believe in I don't know if I haven't read her stance on abortion. I can only imagine that she's against it. But she does. The reason she doesn't believe in IVF is because she thinks that there's a way to extend childbearing age by some wacky ideas that she has, like being out in the sun every morning for 2 hours will extend your childbearing age. I don't know how that works, but I have not, honestly, I'm surprised now that you mentioned this, that I haven't checked specifically about her views on abortion and other reproductive health. I just read the IVF stuff and I was like, yeah, she's crazy.
Yeah, and so this kind of fits into a narrative for me. Whereas, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he has the family lineage, which, you know, kind of, you know, tips towards Democratic, given his uncles, his father, everything else, his sister, who was the former governor of Maryland. And then he had a first past where he was very pro-environment, and he still may have some of those opinions, but that gets diminished in recent years. He hasn't talked nearly as much about that issue, and it's mainly the anti-vaccination stuff and the, you know, kind of pseudoscience healthcare genre stuff that he leads with and focuses on. Now, we'll talk about some of the other positions he stated recently, but that seems to be overwhelming a lot of the conversation with him. Tim, my question to you is, do you think the fact that he talks less about the environment now and so much more about the vaccination stances and his VP, that's her main issue seemingly, is that same thing, is that going to be something where he begins to hurt Trump more than he hurts Biden?
Well, according to the polling at present, no. At present, he is doing he's pulling about 2% more of his vote from Biden than he is from Trump. And I think Trump realizes that, and Trump, by the way, welcomes Kennedy's entry into the race because he also thinks Kennedy hurts Biden worse, and he has said so. As far as the vice presidential pick, that just goes so far historically, if she falls in with the historical norms, because the voters go against the person at the top of the ticket. You look back, Bush Sr. picked the worst person you could possibly pick to run with him as vice president, and he easily won. On the other hand, that same year, Dukakis picked the best person you could think of to pick, and he easily lost. I think she can't do anything but help him a little bit because of her connections and her money, which he sorely needs to get on the ballot. And we can diss him all we want to, but presently, just this week, he scored at 12% and 13% in two polls. He is running better, at least in the polls right now, than any independent candidate since Ross Perot. And I think the Biden people are beginning to pay attention to that. They've actually
put together a team to deal exclusively with Kennedy. So the thing we're going to watch now is not so much positions, but ballot access. Right now he's on the ballot in Utah, and he says he's shortly going to be on the ballot in North Carolina, New Hampshire, Hawaii, Nevada, and Arizona, with more states to come. If he gets on a lot of ballots, just a few votes, he just gets a few votes. He gets 2 or 3% of the vote. I think it hurts. I think it hurts Biden worse. I think a one-on-one race, Biden could beat Trump right now.
Well, Catherine, kind of an extension of that question, let's assume Tim's supposition is right. At this current moment, he hurts Joe Biden worse than Donald Trump. Does Joe Biden need to spend real money, time, and effort against Robert Kennedy Jr. defining a lot of his positions?
Somebody needs to. I don't know if it's Biden or if it's super PACs or if it's, whoever. But somebody, I think someone, some group, some, whether it's Biden or not, needs to alert people that these people are crazy. I mean, there's no, I hate to use that word. So their views are way out in outer space. I mean, it's worse than, I don't know if it's worse, but they're just, it's, yes, someone needs to inform the public of this, of their, views and, but I don't know that it necessarily needs to be Biden himself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's that it's dangerous. I mean, because we're seeing measles making a comeback. Tim?
They're already fighting this battle, guys, and you know where they're beginning to fight it with Kennedy? Among Hispanic voters, and I'll tell you why. Right now, according to the Equus poll, recently done, Kennedy is getting 20% of young Latino voters ages 18 to 34. He is pulling 17% of the Latino vote in Arizona and 21% of the Latino vote in Nevada, with Kennedy on the ballot nationally. Trump actually leads Biden among Hispanic voters. Well, that would be enough to sink Biden in a state like Arizona that he won by less than 11,000 votes, and he certainly has to have Hispanic voters in Nevada. So they have already begun cutting commercials with Vice President Harris on Latin media, and they've sent her to do some events that Latinos were holding. So that's where the ballot, that's where the real battle begins with Kennedy, because Biden has got to have Latino voters in the Southwest. And apparently Kennedy's famous last name,
yeah,
it is helping him because his uncle JFK was very well received by Latins in the whole Western Hemisphere with the outreach that he did. So they're gonna have to go after him.
I recently listened to a biography of Ted Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy did as much as any senator to work on the immigration issue during the second half of the 20th century. And also his father worked with Cesar Chavez, but Cesar Chavez's family actually very publicly endorsed Joe Biden and rebuked that tie-in. I did want to ask real quickly about a candidate that he didn't pick for vice president, because no one knew he was a candidate. But it would have been a fascinating story, to say the least. And, Tim, I am going to come to you with this one before Catherine. And, Catherine, you're welcome to jump in after. But there was rumors that New York Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers was being considered for the VP pick. Had he done that, what would that have done to the candidacy of Robert Kennedy Jr., and how would that have differed from Nicole Shanahan, do you think, Tim?
Well, I think it would have hurt him a lot worse than the pick of her, because Rodgers is a very public person, and some of his positions are really out there and well known. And he probably would have overshadowed Kennedy, and you don't want your number two guy to do that. So I don't really think that Aaron Rodgers was going to seriously consider something like that. He would have been leaving a lot of money on the table to leave the Jets. Plus, he badly wants to come back and play ball after missing the entire season other than a few plays last year. So I don't think that was ever really a serious thing. I'm sure Kennedy considered it, but I don't think Aaron Rodgers actually ever did.
Yeah, and then you would have gotten into the darkness retreats and the use of KO and all kind of different stuff that goes with that. Catherine, any thoughts on that, or if you want to leave that one alone, I understand.
I'll leave that alone. I don't do sports ball.
Yeah. Well, Aaron Rodgers, he's quite a character. That's
we're
having
a hard time understanding you, David.
Well, I'll do my best to on a clear and sunny day in around Georgia, but as ever, my cell phone reception is what it is. But let me ask you the next question, and Catherine, this may be our final one on this topic. The rumor was that Donald Trump would be open to the idea of running with Robert Kennedy Jr. as his running mate, and Robert Kennedy Jr. Abandoning this campaign and becoming Trump's VP. What are your thoughts on that possibility?
I don't even know what that would look like. I mean, it seems preposterous to me. They seem to be, you know, sort of opposites in many ways. In some ways, they're not, but I don't know if that helps Trump or not, honestly. I actually think that Trump is probably better off with Kennedy as a third party than as his running mate. But I could be wrong about that. That whole idea is just kind of mystifying to me. I'm befuddled by it.
Yeah, I will say this. If he did it, he would be giving up any advantages he could try to claim with Operation Lightspeed and getting the vaccine ready if he picked Robert F. Kennedy, you would think. Tim, your thoughts on that rumor and if that would have happened? Or that, I guess that could still happen, but if it were to.
Apparently there was some legs to it. Trump had apparently several times raised that prospect with some of his own people, some of his inner circle. He's intrigued at the prospect of joining on a ticket with a Kennedy. He's always had a fixation with the Kennedy family. He brings the Kennedys up, especially JFK, a lot at his events. And he is of the opinion that having Kennedy with him on the ticket would create this sort of super ticket where he could capitalize on the Kennedy name and win the election big. I don't know if that's true. I think what he would want would be for Kennedy to join the ticket and then never say another word.
Right.
Just stand there and smile and wave and
Trump would mention that his last name was Kennedy, and that would be that. But I think there's probably some validity to this story that Trump has floated the idea pretty heavily with some of his people.
Yeah, actually, after hearing
that he's drawn to the Kennedy name, it just makes it's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, actually, after hearing him speak recently, I guess it was at the VP announcement of Nicole Shanahan, his voice is really not strong.
Well,
him, I know we were talking, and he has some kind of condition, but it really changes the dynamics.
He has a disease. That affects his voice. That's the problem.
And I don't want to make light of that in any way. It's just, but it is when you're a public speaker, that is a big factor. Well, I want to join in to the show right now. Our guest that's come on the show at least three times on the Kudzu Vine, but this is the first time having her on since her new book came out, Hit 'Em Where It Hurts. Welcome, Dr. Rachel Bitcoffer.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here today.
Yeah, glad to have you. Well, just right off the bat, we knew the book was coming out. Last time you talked about it was coming out soon. Now we've had a chance to read and listen to it. Tell us, how has the book been received?
It's being received very well. I don't have enough fame. It's not a New York Times bestseller. What matters on the book is how much is it impacting our campaign strategy for 2024. And in that regard, the book has been more successful than my wildest dreams could have ever been hoping for. When we created it, it was a mission-focused book. It was designed to, get the strategy into hands of people that could execute it. In as many places on the map in 2024 as possible, and that is, feels really good to know we've achieved that.
Yeah, it does seem like the kind of book, when I was listening to it, that lent itself to book clubs, if you will, of, policymakers and campaign strategists and political party leaders at, the county, the district, the state level. Have you had anybody that's, doing that, like reading as a group and then trying to enact things?
Oh, yeah, no, there's a lot of people doing book clubs. I've come into a few of them as a special guest, That's great. I'm sure there's many more book clubs than I'm aware of, but, yeah, I love the book club, and, it's great for me when I find out my favorite thing is this. I'll do something, an event, or just a call with somebody, and they'll show me their copy of the book, and it's indexed. Every other page has got a sticky tab sticking out, right? That's when you know it's mischief managed, right?
Yeah. Well, that's great. I did want to ask one question about the actual content before I pass it to Tim and Catherine, and that was about when you talk about the lessons of Virginia. I remember that, that was the first, big election after Joe Biden was elected president. The Democrats take back the Senate, and it was such a rough night, not only in Virginia, but acutely in Virginia, because I think a lot of folks are like, oh, yeah, Virginia's going to start being Democratic all the time in every race. And you really tell the story, particularly through the issue of education, that was one issue where Democrats really lost that election on. But since then, and this part wasn't in the book, Democrats have done better in Virginia. Kind of tell us the lessons about what went wrong in that first two-year period and then what went right before the next election that we can then take into 2024 across the country.
Yeah, in the book I use Virginia as an example of how Republicans can take something that doesn't even really exist and then turn it into a household word, make the media talk about incessantly, and ended up wedging it against us successfully in Virginia in 2021. And just for folks referencing Georgia, because Virginia is just different. It has elections that are off year. So in Georgia you vote in 22 and 24. In Virginia, you vote in 21, 22, 23, and 24. So one thing that I point out in the book is, like, you know, the strategic shift that we were able to do in time for the 2022 cycle, which is not complete. It was only in parts of the country that ran negative partisanship style campaigns. You know, that all the strategic shift we did is really, it comes down to Dobbs. So, like, if Virginia's cycle had happened before Dobbs, I mean, after Dobbs instead of before, then it would have been a different outcome for sure. And Glenn Youngkin would just be another has-been with, would be already have forgotten about CRT and all of it. Dobbs is really the difference maker. So when you're asking how did we flip back the state legislature in Virginia in 2023, because, again, they had another election that cycle, then the answer was by wedging the Dobbs decision. And not enough, you get an effect in the electorate, whether or not you're tapping directly into that issue. But if you tap into it and increase the natural salience of it, it can have a powerful effect. And we just saw what it did down in Alabama in that special election for their state house.
Yeah, Marilyn Lands went in her state house seat in Huntsville, and that was such a big number flip where it was like a plus seven Republican win, and it went to, like, well into the double figures. Let me ask you, that kind of brings up another question. We've had several special election wins in recent months, and that being one of them. There was the House seat in New York, and there's several others. Of those special election wins, which one do you think is the most predictive of what might happen on a larger scale throughout the country, and why?
Oh, I mean, I think it's the signal all of the totality of the specials. So to be clear, if we were getting some good specials and some bad, I'd be very nervous, especially combined with the, you know, polling advantage. As the outsider, Trump has an advantage in the polling in the 2024 cycle, at least to start, right? I would be very nervous, but there's not a confused signal. So when you ask me to select one, I would say, you know, one would be nice, but it's that every single election is producing the same kind of effect that is what's comforting and why we should expect it to be replicated.
That actually makes a lot of sense. Well, I'm going to pass it along to Tim, who will pass it along to Cap'n for more questions. Tim?
Good evening, Dr. Bitticoffer, and thank you for being with us again tonight. In the book, one of the first things that I noticed was you mentioned that the Democrats sometimes are playing checkers while the Republicans are playing chess. What exactly does that entail, and is it playing out on a national level in this campaign?
Yes, exactly. I mean, what I'm arguing with chess and checkers and what the middle of the book does, first part of the book explains to, you know, demonstrates the why do we have to make the shift? Why do we need a strategy that's different? But in the middle, I lay out and document the asymmetry of long-term strategic planning between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans have been building for about 50 years now an anti-democratic infrastructure. The reason they have our democracy on its knees and, you know, at the edge of the cliff right now is because of all this long-term strategic planning and infrastructure that they created to support their electioneering and media environment. So talking about, you know, that is, it's really important for people to understand that Democrats did not do those things. And then even after it became obvious that Republicans were creating infrastructure, for example, there's something called the American Legislative Exchange Council. It's just one of, you know, five things I profile in the book, and I could have profiled many, many more. I left many, many elements of the Republican, you know, infrastructure not in the book, right? I only picked a few of the key elements, and one of them is heritage, but the other is ALEC, right? We've known ALEC been kicking since 2004, basically. And what ALEC does, folks, is, you know, Republicans gained power in the state legislature in places like Georgia, you know, everywhere, really, by having good timing in a 2010 midterm that gave them power to redistrict off of, right? And so they gerrymandered a lot of these states to enhance their power. And in doing so, they wanted to make use of control of those state legislatures, too, because there are things you can do as long as it doesn't conflict with the Constitution. You can do many things you can't do at the federal level. So they created a policy organization that builds model legislation. And, you know, the early iterations of this stuff brought us some standard things to American politics, things we're familiar with, like quote-unquote right-to-work laws or stand-your-ground laws, right? Those are added constructs. And so, you know, what they have is basically an infrastructure capable of deploying model legislation to various Republican state houses and governors simultaneously to get it into the legislative process, to get it enacted in law. And where it's so effective, you know, a good contemporaneous example for folks is the trans stuff. So after 2022, we saw the spate of legislation all come through, you know, banning, double, you know, gender-neutral bathrooms and girls in sports and gender therapy, you know, any kind of therapy for trans people. That stuff was all ready to go and cooked in one organization, the likes of which we do not have a counterpart. So my argument is, you know, we have to start building this infrastructure. And, you know, in order to do so, we have to leverage the system that we have, not the system that we want. We want to live in a system that has no campaign money, no big money, no corporate interest, no billionaires, but we don't live in that system, and we're never going to have the power to not live in that system until we win power and use that power to change the laws. So what Democrats really need are billionaires who are interested in living in a stable, functioning democracy where NATO is the prevailing geopolitical factor. That way they can trade and have global capitalism in a calm, quiet, and controlled space, which we've enjoyed for 80 years since World War II. We need billionaires spending money on pro-democracy infrastructure that can get model legislation for voting rights pushed out and other things that Republicans are doing. So that's just one example of where they are really playing the game at a level that we're not yet. We're starting to catch up, but it's going to be a while.
Well, I've always been of the opinion that, on the whole, Republicans are meaner than Democrats. and one statement, you mentioned it in the book, Michelle Obama's statement about when they go low, we go high. Although I understand what she was saying, I've always been troubled by that because that really doesn't work with Trump and his supporters, does it?
It's a lovely platitude, you know, if it makes you feel good. But, yeah, no, if you're going to be going into a swing race like this, you know, next Georgia race, and you're talking about, you know, insulin for seniors at $35 and let's get real climate change stuff done, and I did bipartisan infrastructure, you know, historic bipartisan, that's all great and dandy, but the other side's going to say don't vote for Joe Biden. Joe Biden's a socialist. He wants to turn your boy children into girls. He's a groomer. He's going to, you know, he stole the election. I mean, that's very, very rhetorically flamboyant, right? So the swing bucket, that's what they hit the swing bucket in, as I document in the book. They don't go to the swing bucket the way we do and try to prove how great Raphael Warnock is, which he is, and he's a great swing candidate in that regard. They don't do that. What they do is they go and they just, you know, napalm our candidate and our brand and try to win a two-choice race by default. And it taps – it's very easy to do that psychologically because there's a bias humans have to that default, number one. And number two, it's a lot easier to push somebody away from something than to sell a product. It's not a truck. So you're not – when you're selling a candidate, you know, I say in the book, they're just not that into you, okay? And I mean it. Like in the political world, you can feel like pretty important and loved. But when you get out into the broader electorate, voters are not into politics at all. So you're selling not, you know, it's hard enough to sell a product, but imagine trying to sell one that everyone hates.
Republicans understand that. Yeah, you talked a lot about, you know, how to combat Republicans, and you talked a whole lot about full use of mockery as a political tool, and you seem to be very fond of this particular tactic, as I am. Is it one of the most effective counterattacks, mockery, the use of mockery?
Yeah, so again, this would not be the case if we were talking about a normal opposition, the old school Republican Party that used to exist, okay?
Right.
But once they move out of the realm of reality, right, strategic mocking becomes really critical. And here's the reason why, is because if you don't mock their crazy Earth 2 stuff, because the stuff that they're arguing is crazy, okay? It's not based in reality at all. And if you try to have a rational conversation about an irrational thing, like the big lie, right? That's exactly what happened with the big lie. We all knew Trump was going to claim fraud in the election. We all knew that he was flying around, or at least the people that were watching, that he was putting infrastructure in place to contest the election. So when he started pretending that it was stolen, we could have just said, and we've known he was going to do this for months, we're not going to play along. But instead, we decided to treat the allegations as something that was factually, that needed to be facially challenged, right, and disproven. And by doing that, we legitimated it right out the gate.
Mm-hmm.
So the power of the mocking strategy is to avoid normalizing the abnormal. We're in a pot that's so hot now, it's so close to boiling, but it's been getting, you know, hotter and hotter. So gradually, we don't really, I mean, unless you take time to take stock of what we've endured over the last 6 years, you can forget, like, how far off of the path of normality this Republican Party is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to do everything we can for average people to see that abnormality, because if we legitimate it, then we have really done not only reality a disservice, but ourselves a disservice in terms of our ability to get through this moment and get American public to make a rational, fact-based choice.
Yeah. So that leads me right into my final question for you before I see it. Send it over to Catherine. I believe that democracy is front and center on the ballot this year. Right on the dust jacket of your book, as a matter of fact, are the capitalized words say democracy. Are we making a mistake, though, in thinking that the average person who doesn't closely follow politics even realizes that?
Well, that's the whole point of doing it, is because, no, it's not, we're not making a mistake. My argument is no one knows. So that sick feeling you have in your stomach, and people who are listening to the Kudzu Vine, I know, will have this feeling as well. Like, the point of the book, the front half of the book, is to get this point across. No one else has that feeling, okay? Average people out there that you're driving past or standing with in the grocery store, they don't have that feeling because they don't read any news or politics. They have no idea what Donald Trump has planned. They've never heard of Project 2025 or Agenda 47 or his comments about becoming a dictator, any of that. They have no idea he's planning on mass deportations and loyalty tests of Muslims and all of these, you know, taking control of the public schools. And they will never know that unless we tell them. So the answer to that question is yes, they don't know. And that is why specifically we have to make that the theme, because it's the only way they will ever know. Otherwise, they'll walk into the ballot booth in November and they'll be thinking about something like gas prices or inflation or crime or whatever Republicans serve up for them, border invasion, and they won't realize that if they hire Republicans this election cycle, they're not going to have an opportunity to fire them. And think about representation, the kind of representation you'll get from a government that cannot be fired.
Right. Well, I thank you for that, and I've really enjoyed your book. I want to tell you in going out that when it's time to man the ramparts, I'll be glad to be standing beside you.
Oh, I'm so honored to hear that.
Let me send it to Catherine now. Catherine?
Yeah. Hey, Rachel. It's great to have you on the show again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Of course, I want to talk about abortion because we all need to be talking about it more and in a normal way, because it's a normal procedure that happens thousands and thousands of times in this country. I cannot resist from time to time using the phrase that I hate to use, that I hated when my mother said it to me, but I told you so. How do you resist not saying that, like, every day to every person that you talk to? Because we all of us who have been fighting this battle, and on the front lines, or even just in our, at our, you know, dining room table, have said for years that this was going to happen. Like we all said, let those Republicans in there, let those guys into the Supreme Court, and we're going to lose our right to abortion.
Exactly.
And here we are.
Yes. Yep.
And I am so, like, I don't watch a lot of commercial television. I tend to stream things, so I don't see a lot of commercials. But lately I've seen a couple from Joe Biden that I just really like. Like, he's front and center talking about choice. I don't like the phrasing, but I know that that's tested and that's what people like to hear. So, but is
did he
that,
say choice?
I mean,
is that what he said?
He's saying he uses the phrase right to choose all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, it's so much more than that. But
oh,
I know
yeah.
that
I
that,
talk about how minimizing that is in the book. Yes, definitely. Because
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
it sounds like you're going to a drive-through.
Yeah, right. But it does sound. It does. I know that it does resonate with voters. I've seen some of that data, so that's fine. You know, we can have that bigger conversation after we, you know, get Biden reelected and start making these changes. So I'm cool. I'm good with it. But do you think, this is my question, do you think that this is going to, I mean, I know that you and I both think that abortion is definitely on the ballot this year. Do you think we need more conversations about it, or do we just need to remind people?
We need every, we need, so here's the problem. In Georgia right now, there are women that will, until they bleed out, have to sit in a hospital bleeding out and waiting for sepsis to get an abortion because of a medical complication, have A, no idea that abortion was overturned, and even if she heard it, thought, well, it had nothing to do with me, and also maybe it was Joe Biden that did it. That's the, like, you know, working knowledge differential that an average voter is going to be bringing into these situations. So, you know, we can't talk about Roe enough. We cannot possibly run enough advertising to, you know, make sure women and voters in states like Georgia find out that, you know, they're being medically tortured by the Republican Party. So to get salience is so difficult. So think about with CRT in Virginia. They needed everyone on it. The state legislative races ran on it. The governor's race, the lieutenant governor, and the secretary of state or attorney general in Virginia all ran on CRT. So that, and they didn't talk about much else, because if you talk about a lot of things, you don't break through on any one thing. So when we talk about abortion being on the ballot, it's really important for folks to understand. In 2022, it was quite clear the campaigns that ran aggressively on that issue, on freedom, right, because it's not choice, it's freedom, who ran aggressively on that issue, cleaned it up. They all won. And the places that they didn't wasn't enough, right? So you have to run specifically on it, and you have to make it an aggressive and centerpiece part of your argument, which is great, because the argument is, you know, they're coming for our freedom, and abortion is the, you know, tangible, concrete example that you can hand to the voter that makes it real.
I agree with you, and I think that if we can focus on that, that we can win. I think it's the winning argument. Not just abortion, but the idea of taking rights away. I think that is because, you know, it's a slippery slope, like we always say.
Well,
you know, once
it's
abortion,
quite clear they're coming
and
for
and
everybody.
We said this.
Yeah.
We said this when we saw the law, when we were working on that law and the legislation and constitutional amendment in Alabama, because I was working on that with Planned Parenthood. We were like, we looked at this and we said, well, what about IVF? And then, sure enough, 2 years later, here we are. And then that candidate in Alabama ran strictly on that and won. So
exactly.
I'm glad
they finally
are listening.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. And I so appreciate your, strident support of that, and your clear messaging and understanding of how important this is. So thank you for that. I don't have any other questions, but I wanted to just ask you, is there anything on your mind that you wanted to tell our listeners about? Anything specific?
Yeah, I mean, I really urge people to read this book. If you think you know a lot about politics, much of what you know is maybe wrong. So the first half of this book is getting us to understand how the normal electorate is. You know, if you think that the election has been going on for a long time and it's coming into the final stretch, you are not normal. You're like me, and you are not normal. Normal people, the election won't even, they won't even begin to even contemplate or think or read anything on it. If they ever do, it will be in September. It will not be for months.
Or in November.
Well, not quite that. But, yeah, it's very much, you know, an insider. We have been watching all this stuff. Other people haven't seen Donald Trump in 4 years. We need to remind them of how horrible he is. We need to apprise them of his plans, because he plans on collapsing the civil service. He plans on mass deportation. He's planning a national abortion ban, which will give you nowhere to run, right? And we have to make sure people don't just hear about how he's, you know, a jerk and he says terrible things and he's got bad character. It's not about his rhetoric even. It's about his plans. They're on his website. They're in that manual, Project 2025. People need to familiarize themselves with that stuff, and if they could read my book, it's a good starting point for them to translate their own sphere of influence into activism so we can save our democracy.
Got it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much. You guys have a great day.
You too. Going back to David.
Just one quick question, and then we're going to let you, you know, plug the book and everything else. You mentioned mass deportations. The polling with Latino voters is inconclusive at best. Like Donald Trump seems to be gaining with Latino voters at worst. I think Joe Biden do a good job picking a Latino campaign manager. But given the stakes for Latino people in many cases being greater than most of us, what can Democrats do to get Latino voters back to 2008, 2012, and even 2020 numbers?
They need to make sure they tell Latino voters what Trump has planned for them, because they don't magically know. Again, the front half of the book, the whole point of that book is getting people to understand maybe 15% of adults in this country on our side, not the Fox side, read and watch the news and could tell you about, like, you could have a conversation about contemporaneous things that happen in the news that you and I can talk about. We can talk about Trump's cases, and we can talk about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But, like, other people, like, you know, when Speaker McCarthy got vacated, I couldn't go to Starbucks and be like, did you guys hear what happened? And they'd be like, well, yeah, can you believe that? No, they don't know, dude. No, it's a thing that, you know what I mean? Like, other than the Super Bowl, there's no shared experience in this country, and we need to make sure that we understand if we want Latinos to freak out and vote for Democrats because they're facing really, really, it's going to be a national show-me-your-papers type situation, like the law they passed in Arizona in 2010, which terrorized the Latino community because it meant anyone with any, you know, looks Spanish, has a last name, can't speak English, can get caught up in their net. And it's a very intimidating and scary experience to be rounded up and have to prove that you have a right to stay in the country. People are going to be experiencing that in a very visceral, very real way. We're going to see the dreamers, you know, these kids that we got to come register with the federal government so they could stay in the country and have, you know, at least quasi-legal status. Well, now the Trump administration will have a data bank of every dreamer in the country. This is a all-hands-on-deck moment, but we can't just assume Latinos know it and they're voting for Trump anyway. The reason is they don't know it.
Yeah, great point. Well, go ahead and tell our listeners where they can get the book, and then if you want to share any other social media, Substack, other podcasts you're working on, anything, just tell our listeners.
Yeah, so you can get the book at whatever bookseller you prefer. There's also an audio book, but you have to listen to my annoying voice read it to you. And you can, you know, it's also on the big websites like Amazon. So it's really easy to find. It's called Hit 'Em Where It Hurts, How to Save Democracy by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game. And it's a great, you know, quick read. It's meant to bring you up to speed on what political science has known for 50-something years about the American electorate, which has somehow never made it into our analysis. And that's what made, you know, breaking into the election analysis world pretty easy for me, because I'm like, no, that's not how any of this works. So if you want to understand how things actually work, it's a great read. And then you can also check out my blog podcast. It's on Substack. It's called The Cycle on Substack. And I usually don't firewall that material because I'm trying to get the word out to as many people as possible right now so we don't collapse into a fascist hellhole.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, I listened to the book. I found you, your teaching of the book, wonderful, because you are a teacher by trade, and so I appreciated actually getting to hear it from the author better than a third-party reader, which a lot of them are. So I liked it, so I'm going to defend that. But once I want to appreciate thank you for coming on the show, and hopefully we can get you on to talk more about issues somewhere down the road, either summer or fall.
Yeah, let's do it, and we'll finally know what's going to happen with the polling, but we can't use it for much right now. So,
great point.
Thank you, Doctor. Thanks, guys.
Yes. All right. Hit 'Em Where It Hurts. You know, get it just anywhere. I think it really is one of those books where it's pierced the filter, and you can go into a store and sell, you know, lots of books, and you're going to find it. It's really around and out there with a big, much bigger profile than a lot of political books from a, you know, well-regarded professor of political science. Well, let's go ahead and talk about one final topic, and that was Nebraska. And I guess this is still a bit of an ongoing topic, and they've talked about this before, but if you don't know, Nebraska allocates their electoral votes a bit differently than 48 other states. Maine does it the same way, where two electoral votes are based, I guess, on the senators, and whoever wins the state as a whole gets those two. And then the other three congressional districts in Nebraska are decided on who wins that individual congressional district. Well, one of the congressional districts, the one based in Omaha, is very persuadable. It has actually gone in recent years for Democrats. Joe Biden won it in 2020, and other years in which the Republican wins, I guess more handily out in 2004, it has a chance of going Republican. So it's truly a swing district at this point. I think there may be a point in which it becomes a city district that's pretty blue if they keep this system. Well, Donald Trump put a lot of pressure on a lot of the legislators up there. The governor was supportive of this, and here's one thing. The governorship is a partisan office in Nebraska. Members of the unicameral, which are called senators, are nonpartisan. They're independent, even though they may have clear political leanings either in their public statements or how they vote or who they endorse, but still they are independent. And the initial push this time was voted down. And so that system will stay the same, where that, in particular, Omaha district will be in play. Tim, your thoughts on this whole process, we'll just start there.
Yeah, I'm not ready to say this thing is dead yet, and I'll tell you why. A couple of things have happened. There's a state senator by the name of Michael McDonnell out there, and he switched parties. And what that did was give the Republicans 33 members in a 49-seat legislature, which would be make it filibuster-proof, anything that comes up. Now, then you add into the mix a gentleman by the name of Hank Kuhneman. Now, he is a pro-Trump pastor of a big church in the Omaha area, and he's organized his members to call legislators to pressure them to change the electoral vote allocation. Well, it came to the attention of good old Charlie Kirk. Well, he's coming out there, and on Tuesday they're going to have a big rally to try to put pressure on the legislature during the last 5 days that they're in session to do something. Right now, the votes are not there. We talked about that earlier this week. It was not even close to passing. But what they're trying to pull now is some attempt to attach this bill to other legislation. One state senator has even tried to take the winner-take-all bill out of committee where it's languishing at the moment and attach it to an unrelated bill as an amendment. Now, that's a violation of the state's constitution to even do that. And you know what she said? She said, just ignore the law and do it anyway. And, of course,
yeah,
David, I might mention they don't mention the state of Maine. That's fine up there because Trump gets the electoral vote up there. And Trump, of course, is running his mouth. And so I'd give this another week before I decided it was DOA.
Yeah, it did lose pretty handily in that first time. And that state senator you mentioned, who I'm still unclear on how he switched parties since it's a nonpartisan body, because I actually checked that after you sent it to make sure, because I did a presentation in graduate school based on Nebraska's unicameral. And I guess maybe they have partisan voter registration. Also, you know, the people kind of can make public statements and whatnot. But he did say that he was still against changing the state law. Apparently, they're very proud of it. One thing to keep in mind is that Omaha, the TV stations, get a lot of campaign ad dollars from commercials that will then be run in that for that electoral vote. And then, of course, you may get some visits from really both candidates, because that seat then becomes in play. That is another reason in which I think some people, even if they were favoring Donald Trump, still understand the value of being, you know, wooed and sought after. Catherine, your thoughts on this possible change?
Well, I guess I just feel like if it's within the law to do things like this, then let Nebraska be Nebraska. If they want to keep the law or change the law, I mean, it sounds like it could be good for Biden to get that one extra vote, the one extra electoral vote. But if it's not what they want, if they feel like they should have a winner-take-all, then I don't know. I feel like it's a lot of conversation and a lot of discussions. If we're down to one vote, then we're screwed. So I don't know. I'm indifferent about it. Would be mine.
Well, you look at it this way. You say we're screwed. Okay, if you go under the supposition that Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin are far more likely to go for Joe Biden than the Sun Belt route, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, then if Joe Biden wins those three states in the Midwest and that Omaha vote, he wins the presidency. If he doesn't have that Omaha vote, wins those three states in the Midwest, loses the Sun Belt states, you'd have to assume then, you know, North Carolina with that, then it becomes a tie and it goes to the House of Representatives, and then you can only imagine what possibly could happen from there. Really, the country, I don't know how much it could survive, you know, that process, given how tenuous things are after seeing January 6th. So that's where it kind of comes into play. It's a safeguard, giving that clear electoral victory by keeping Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, which I think are more likely than the Sun Belt states to, you know, go Democratic. And so that's why, you know, mathematically it gets important. You know,
yeah,
hopefully he gets the Sun Belt too when he's got both routes.
Yeah, well, symbolically it's very important too. That's only one piece of the puzzle that Trump and his bunch are trying to put together. They really do want to rig the system so that even if they lose, they'll somehow win. And they you know, change the rules or do whatever you got to do. Do what that female state senator, who's very pro-Trump, by the way, said, hey, just ignore our law. Just ignore the state constitution and let's do it anyway. Well, that's right out of Trump's playbook. They just, you know, if I feel like doing it, just doing it, do it anyway, and then let's see somebody try to stop me. If they succeed there, then they try to put the pressure on state legislatures not to, you know, like they did before, not to accept the Biden slate of electors if he wins the state. Well, what if they succeed in that? You know?
Yeah. I mean, this goes back to 2008, in which Sarah Palin said the real American Americans, real America, and really, really pretty much there's a lot of people that thought there's a real America and a plastic fake America. And, you know, even if the plastic fake America is 52% of the vote, they don't count. They're not the real America. And I think that's where that narrative comes from. But that's a whole long discussion for future times. But next week, we're excited to preview that show. We're going to have Millen Singh back on the show. And Millen is into another endeavor. He works for Blueprint America, the site, if you look up Blueprint, you know, politics, something to that effect. You're going to see the research they're doing. They're doing all kind of research pieces about, you know, demographic information, policy information, all of that. And we're going to have Millen on the show and discuss that next week on the Kudzu Vine. But until then, good night, everyone.
Good night,
guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the...